From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This is the hour when the numbers really start adding up.
Polls have closed in 40 states, plus Washington, D.C., and we're looking at who will get those 432 electoral votes.
So far, the Associated Press has called several states, with 66 electoral votes going to Donald Trump and 48 to Hillary Clinton.
Several toss-up states remain. Yes, toss-ups. We're talking about North Carolina, where some voting was extended this evening, plus New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and a big one, Florida.
We start watching returns this hour from Arizona and Colorado, two states where Latino turnout could have a big impact.
And our eyes are also on the Senate. The AP has called several races, including Indiana, a seat Democrats hope to capture.
That seat is staying Republican. Joining us now with more details on these races and other races is NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
What can you tell us?
Well, you know, at this hour, you're going to see a whole slew of states close, 14 states, more than a dozen. You'll see a place like New York. We just have a call now from the Associated Press for Illinois for Hillary Clinton, obviously expected. So the totals now you will start to see really add up. So those totals that we have on the NPR map, it's now 68 for Clinton, 66 for Trump. You will see these numbers really start to move and shift around. A couple places to really highlight what's happening tonight. Virginia, much closer than I think a lot of polls had suggested. You see about half the vote, if you're playing along at home, in Loudoun and Fairfax counties in northern Virginia. Those should be strongholds for Democrats. Traditionally, what you've seen in past elections is Democrats being down 3 or 4 points because of a lot of the western, southwestern counties that have come in for Republicans. And then Democrats have made a strong move later on in the night as those northern Virginia counties come in. Although 5-point or 4-point lead for Trump, could portend a fairly close race. It's why it hasn't been called so far.
Fairfax County, big, a million plus, or about a million people in that.
It's a very large county. But let's also look at a couple of the other more important places as well. Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, very close in both places. In North Carolina, one place to highlight is Wake County, where Raleigh is, the heart of the Research Triangle. She was up about 100,000 votes in the state and her margin almost entirely out of Wake County. And Robert, where have you ever heard this before? But Florida could come down to Palm Beach and Broward counties.
Stop.
I don't know that they have Chads anymore, but...
But we did hear from North Carolina, which you mentioned, that Durham County, which is not, it's all part of the Triangle area.
Correct.
That's Durham, where Duke is, which is also part of the very upscale and typically liberal part of the state of North Carolina.
That's right. You know, there's an old joke now, or now a new joke, I guess. There's an area called Cary, which is right outside Raleigh. The acronym the locals use is a containment area for relocated Yankees.
It's a famous software. It was built by a great software developer in North Carolina. Well, that's what we know so far. As to what it means, we have Mara Liasson for that. Mara? What do you make of all this so far?
Well, we don't know what it means until we see some of these battleground states being called one way or another. But what we've been watching the whole night is whether Donald Trump could pull off what's a pretty unorthodox path, which is boosting the white vote and particularly the white non-college vote to historic levels never seen before. We do know from exit polls that he is winning the white non-college vote about 65-29%. That's what he's been polling more or less all along. That's a lot better than Mitt Romney did with his demographic. And what we don't know is, are they turning out by in greater than numbers than they ever have before? Hillary Clinton obviously relying on the Obama coalition of millennials and African-American voters, Hispanic voters. We'd heard there was a surge among Hispanic voters in early voting. And of course, we're waiting in Florida for a lot of those counties, which are just like in Virginia, the big, high, densely populated counties to finish turning their vote in.
Domenico, you have an
idea. The AP has now called Texas for Donald Trump right at poll close time, 9:01. There was some discussion as to whether or not Texas might be within single digits this time, which would be the first time in 20 years. It may very well be that the exit polls are showing, at least the people who are doing the modeling, that they may not be the case, or at least it's big enough that they can make the call right at poll close time. But those exit polls later on in the night for how Hispanics voted are going to be a major thing to watch for the future of the political map.
I think we're going to hear some more about Hispanic voters right now.
Hispanics have been an instrumental vote in the state of Nevada. That's where NPR's Elsa Chang is right now on the line. Elsa, are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm doing well. So polls are still open there, right?
People
are still voting.
Right, until 7 p.m. Pacific time tonight, yes.
What can you tell us? You're talking with people? What are you gleaning out there?
Well, yeah, there absolutely has been a surge among Hispanic voters over especially the last 2 weeks in Nevada during early voting. You know, one-fifth of the voters in the state are Hispanic, but historically, Latino voter turnout has lagged. This year, several of the precincts with the heaviest Hispanic populations in Nevada saw much greater turnout during early voting as compared to 2012. You know, one of the scenes that went viral last week was the image of a Hispanic grocery store called Cardenas in Las Vegas. It was an early voting site. And in the last hours of the night on Friday, just as early voting was closing, the place was still jammed with Hispanic voters waiting in line to vote. The line, like, wrapped around the building. The Trump campaign actually tried earlier today to set aside some of those votes at Cardenas, alleging that they were cast after polls should have been closed. But that attempt failed in court today. And, we basically have seen the machine of outgoing Democratic leader Harry Reid helping drive up the Latino vote in Nevada.
Nevada is also the home state of Joe Heck, and he got on a lot of people's radar because he started to symbolize the difficulty that some Republicans were having negotiating their relationship with Donald Trump.
That's absolutely correct. Heck actually was leading in the polls early on, but he ran into some trouble in early October, shortly after the video, the 2005 video of Trump basically saying he groped women without their consent. Heck, after that video surfaced, said that he could no longer support Donald Trump, that it was a very personal decision for him. And he got some of the angriest blowback among the Republicans who disavowed Donald Trump at that point. And he's kind of been, you know, struggling in the polls. He's been locked in a virtual tie with his Democratic opponent, Catherine Cortez Masto, ever since. Absolutely. I mean, like, Heck would be asked, you know, well, who are you going to vote for? He said, well, definitely not Hillary Clinton. But he would never answer the question all the way up until Election Day. He would never answer the question of who exactly he would vote for. And a lot of conservatives in this state just thought that he wasn't being a team player. He wasn't supporting their man.
How did you see that play out in the Senate races around the country? Because you cover Congress and you've been steeped in this stuff for a long time. Democrats think they have an opening to take the Senate back.
Right, exactly. It's been an issue, especially in the really, really tight races. It's been an issue that's hounded, for instance, Kelly Ayotte, Republican contender. She's a Republican incumbent in New Hampshire. She actually has tried to do a very delicate dance. She very early on said that she would support Donald Trump, but she would not endorse him. And a lot of Democrats made fun of that position, basically saying that she was trying to have it both ways. And then during one of the debates against her Democratic opponent, Governor Maggie Hassan, she was asked, do you think Donald Trump is a role model? And at first she said, absolutely. But after the debate, after receiving a ton of blowback from people, she kind of backtracked on those comments, and she's never quite recovered or quite elegantly explained what she meant by absolutely, because then she later said, well, not really, that was a mistake. So it has been this very awkward, delicate dance for a lot of Republican candidates. Rob Portman, though, has, you know, he has had a very healthy lead all the way up. It's been already called for him in Ohio. He's someone who didn't have to really deal with that delicate dance in Ohio.
Because
his lead was so healthy.
He took a stand.
And he had a very hefty lead going into the election day weeks. An interesting place where it actually played was also Indiana. Evan Bayh, former Senator Evan Bayh, the Democratic candidate, he was running in a state where Trump had the lead. And so Bayh kind of had to sell himself as an outsider, you know, to appeal to Trump supporters, saying that he could shake up the system. But at the same time, he couldn't lose voters who were feeling still nostalgic about him as being an insider, someone who was a longtime governor and senator in Indiana. Bayh has lost the Senate race in Indiana, in large part because of sort of getting clobbered by Republicans for not spending enough time in Indiana after leaving the Senate and spending a lot of
difficult
time in the private
for any
sector.
Establishment Republican. NPR's Elsa Chang. Thanks, Elsa. We'll talk to you later.
You're welcome.
Speaking of that Indiana race, we're going to turn now to Annie Ropeek of Indiana Public Broadcasting, who is at Evan Bayh's election night event in Indiana. He lost that Senate race earlier to Republican Congressman Todd Young. Annie, What do the people that buy a headquarters or at their evening event, what do they think happened? Why did they lose?
You know, a lot of people here, Robert, are not too surprised that Evan Bayh lost this race. They are pointing to his sort of abrupt dropout of Indiana politics back in 2010 when he was facing off with Dan Coats, who is retiring now, for this same seat, and instead chose to go to D.C. and consult for a lobbying firm and kind of leave Indiana politics for a while. And a lot of people point to that as a reason that he was not able to kind of come back into this race at the last second and gain traction. They feel that he sort of abandoned the state and then parachuted back in and didn't make a strong enough case, especially in the face of a huge and expensive and brutal attack campaign by state Republicans to win back that seat.
He is the scion of an Indiana political dynasty, Evan Bayh.
Yeah, that's right. This is the first race he's ever lost, actually.
He had been governor of the state, hadn't he, as well as being senator, or do I have that wrong? Well, no matter.
Yeah, that's right. He was governor for most of the 90s, and then he was in this Senate seat from 1999 to 2011, and his father, Birch Bayh, was also a senator in the 60s and 70s.
And now the news is that his bid to return to the U.S. Senate has failed. Evan Bayh defeated by Republican Todd Young. Annie Ropeek, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to NPR's Pam Fessler, who is here in the studio. Pam, you have been paying attention to the polls, specifically any allegations about voter fraud, which that's kind of been in the ether the last couple of days. What have you been seeing out there?
Right. Well, we're not seeing too much. There were a lot of predictions that we're going to have total chaos at the polls. And even though they're not
so good.
Right. So far, so good. Basically, the kinds of problems that we're seeing are the types of things that we usually see in polling places.
Which are what?
The types of things like long lines, malfunctioning machines. There were some problems in Durham County, North Carolina, when the electronic poll books that they used to sign people in when they first come to the polling places, they didn't work early this morning. And in fact, the state has agreed to extend voting in some of those precincts as a result, because some voters were actually turned away. There were also some issues with what's called vote flipping, where people touch one name on a voting machine, a touchscreen machine, and then another name, the opponent's name, lights up.
Yeah, that would seem to be a problem.
That is very unnerving for many voters. But it turns out that some people, and Donald Trump was one of them, said, you know, he thought that there was something suspicious about this. Generally, it's attributed to aging equipment. The machine needs to be recalibrated. Uh-huh. And almost all the time, the voter can actually correct it before they cast the ballot.
GOP nominee Donald Trump had called on his supporters to go to the polls to make sure everything was on the up and up. Did that materialize into any kind of tension?
Yeah. There were some poll monitors that came and watched the polls, and even videotaping some reports, but just scattered reports of that. I mean, these, you know, massive teams of vigilantes that some people were fearing would come to the polls and intimidate voters, they just did not materialize. I mean, there were a few altercations. There was a fight, actually, in Jupiter, Florida, between a Trump supporter and a Clinton supporter, and somebody pepper spray the other one, but that is just was very, very limited. It just seems like a lot of the problems did not materialize, even though I know some of the polling places are still open.
Lastly, there were a lot of concerns about what voters would face this year because of all the new voter ID laws and other restrictions that were imposed by states over the last couple of years. Did that have a big impact? Do we know yet?
Well, I mean, one of the things we'll never know is how many people did not show up at the polls because of some of these requirements. We'll just never know, you know, if they couldn't meet the ID requirement or there were cutbacks in early voting. What we did see, though, is that there was a lot of confusion over some of the new rules, especially in places like Texas, which had a new voter ID requirement, and then it was changed at the last minute, and voters complained that they were just getting mixed messages. And even in places like Pennsylvania, some voters complained that they were being asked to show an ID when, in fact, it wasn't required. So I think a lot of it was confusion.
And NPR's Pam Fessler will check in with you throughout the evening.
Thank you.
And you're listening to special coverage from NPR of the 2016 presidential election. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. You can find our live blog at npr.org. Stay with us.
One of the most closely contested races for the U.S. Senate this year is in New Hampshire. The incumbent Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte has been challenged by the state's governor, Democrat Maggie Hassan. That race has polled very close, and it appears to be close tonight. Joining us from New Hampshire Public Radio is Josh Rogers. Josh, what can you tell us about the results?
Well, right now the results, you know, seem to be tight. There's not too many definitive. I mean, there are too many precincts that are really going to be determinative of the outcome. I'm at the Ayotte headquarters. They say that, you know, they understand that they need heavy turnout in rural areas if they're going to win. They say that's been their plan all along, and you know, they're expecting a long night.
Could you detect any difference in the sophistication of the get out the vote operation from either side in New Hampshire?
Well, the Democratic operation was certainly more conspicuous, but the Ayotte campaign, you know, they were playing things a little bit closer to the chest. I mean, Ayotte had to run alone due to her differences with Donald Trump and her differences with another member of the Republican ticket up here, Frank Ginta, a congressman who she wanted to resign over a campaign finance issue he had. And so she was really running under her own flag and was really running her own campaign and her own get out the vote efforts. On the Democratic side, all that has been very integrated and has been for months. And so Democrats feel that they have the edge there. They have had the edge in recent elections. And, you know, in a presidential year, New Hampshire has gone Democrat 5 out of the last 6 times. And, you know, the thinking has been that Kelly would need to outperform Donald Trump, as she has been in the polls, but outperform him by, you know, 5 points or so in order to win. And we'll see if that happens.
Well, how is Donald Trump doing in the race for New Hampshire?
You know, it's, you know, he won big here in the primary. A lot of the Republican towns haven't come in fully yet. So, you know, the early numbers suggest that Hillary Clinton is winning. He's certainly carrying one of the early results. Some of the more liberal towns have voted incredibly heavy. Hanover, where Dartmouth College is, came in 85% for Hillary Clinton, which is, you know, you'd expect her to win there, but that's pretty staggering. A lot of the Republican towns haven't come in yet. Donald Trump, you know, this was the place he first won. He held a rally last night where there were, you know, close to 10,000 people, some from Massachusetts, but, you know, it's really too early to know what's going to go on.
Okay. Josh Rogers, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Josh with New Hampshire Public Radio, where, as Pete described it, the race both for president in that state and also for the Senate seat being defended by Republican Kelly Ayotte, both races extremely close.
And right now we're looking at an electoral vote count. I believe I'm right here. Domenico, correct me if I'm wrong. Hillary Clinton, 97. Donald Trump, 129. Although it's going to be a long night.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out Hillary Clinton did pick up New York. We mentioned that Donald Trump had picked up Texas. Also, a key Senate race was called in Illinois, which was one that Democrats thought they would pick off, and they did.
Stay with us. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
8:18, polls closed in Minnesota 18 minutes ago. Today, no indication of any major voting problems in the state that we're aware of. No House races called yet in Minnesota, but history has been made in the House of Representatives,
Minnesota State House
of Representatives, where Ilhan Omar will become the first Somali-American to be elected to a state legislature. She defeated the longtime Representative Phyllis Kahn in the primary 60B in Minneapolis in August. Mike Mulcahy, our political editor here with me. I'm Tom Cran, starting with just a bit of news, but not a lot of numbers.
Right. We're still waiting for numbers to start coming in, Tom. An interesting night shaping up, that's for sure, in some of these presidential battleground states. Very close race. And we'll see what happens in Minnesota as soon as some of the numbers start rolling in.
The calls have been made in neighboring states in the presidential race. Donald Trump has won South Dakota and North Dakota, 3 electoral votes each. No big surprise there. We've got our eyes on 3 tight races, at least according to polling, and 3 expensive races for the U.S. House of Representatives here in Minnesota, 3 of our 8 districts.
Right.
Competitive
races in the 2nd, 3rd, and 8th.
So we'll bring you the latest when we have it. We'll bring you those numbers when we have them. Make mprnews.org your second screen all evening long. A live blog with real-time results from the presidential race and all of Minnesota's congressional contests, as well as Minnesota's 10 electoral votes contributing to the big story tonight. 8:20, Minnesota Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.
From From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Martin. And here's the latest. Donald Trump has won Arkansas, Texas, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, and Kansas. Hillary Clinton has won the states of New York and Illinois.
So far, the Associated Press has called several states, with 129 electoral votes going to Donald Trump and 97 to Hillary Clinton. The polls are closed in 40 states and the District of Columbia.
We are awaiting word on some big toss-up states in this election, including Virginia, New Hampshire, Florida, and North Carolina. And it could be a pretty late night for some of them.
We're also watching some big races in the U.S. Senate. The AP is reporting that in Illinois, Democratic Representative Tammy Duckworth has won that Senate seat, defeating Republican Senator Mark Kirk. And in Indiana, Republicans won that seat, with Republican Representative Todd Young defeating former Senator Evan by a Democrat. That's a seat that was held by a Republican who is retiring. That's Senator Coates. So I believe, and Domenico Montanaro can correct me if I'm wrong, that so far the Duckworth win in Illinois is the first change of party of a
Correct. Of a
Senate seat.
That's right. I mean, we're really only watching 9 to 11 Senate races as it is, and most of those are held by Republican incumbents. Indiana, for example, was called, and Evan Bayh, Democrats had big hopes that he would have a chance there to win. But you saw how wide a margin Donald Trump won by. Evan Bayh had a very rough October. He wound up losing to Representative Todd Young, so that one's off the board for Democrats.
So in a nutshell, with North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, still close, New Hampshire for that matter, so far nothing unexpected, no surprises have taken place this evening.
Well, I mean, I think that the surprise is frankly just how close many of these places are. Virginia, I think, was not expected to be as close as it is. Hillary Clinton had had a fairly significant lead in most of the polls heading into tonight, and you're seeing that race within just a couple of points here, with Donald Trump ahead. Still not all of Northern Virginia in. Fairfax County, only about 61% of the vote in. Loudoun County, about 85% of the vote in. So this could close late. That's traditionally where Democrats pick up most of their vote.
Clinton is actually winning. She's well ahead in Loudoun County.
Sure.
Loudoun County in the past has reflected
it's
what the state
swing.
As
yeah.
a whole has been like, but we'll see if that holds up.
Well, but I think that that's changed because you've had a lot of exurban growth and a big change in the northern exurbs and not necessarily reflecting the vote total.
Mara? Are you surprised at how close things appear
yes.
right now? Yes.
Well, I am surprised, especially because in states like Virginia, which most people had figured was already kind of put away for Hillary Clinton, Florida, we always expected to be close. Barack Obama only won Florida by 74,000 votes last time. But I am surprised it's close, especially because what we know about just the differences in the campaigns, just the fact that Donald Trump didn't seem to be interested in investing in a ground game. He pretty much farmed it out to the RNC. And Hillary Clinton basically had the best get-out-the-vote operation that money could buy. You know, she invested heavily in data and analytics. She really focused on the early vote. Of course, that's out of necessity since Democratic voters are harder to get to the polls. So Democrats put more effort into getting them in early, kind of locking them in. But yes, I'm very surprised that it's this close. But we have yet to have a single battleground state called. So we're really in a kind of suspended animation here. Until we see some battleground states, we really don't know which way this race is going.
Earlier this evening, Marco Rubio won re-election to the U.S. Senate. Here's what he had to say.
I know people feel betrayed, and you have a right to. Every major institution in our society has failed us. The media, the government, big business, Wall Street, academia, they've all failed us. And so people are so frustrated and angry. But we must channel that anger and frustration into something positive. Let it move us forward as energy to confront and solve our challenges and our problems. America has never had an easy era. Florida has never had an easy era. Our state has always confronted great challenges, and so too has our people. And yet in each generation, Americans have stepped forward to confront their challenges and embrace their opportunities. And now the time has come for us to do the same.
And of course, when he speaks of our state, he's speaking of the state of Florida, where Marco Rubio has won re-election, but where it's still too close between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton to see who has won the presidential race there. We're going to turn now to Sam Tannenhaus, historian, writer at large for the New York Times, author of The Death of Conservatism. Sam, you have written extensively on conservatism and the Republican Party. In that story, that odd couple, what's happened this year? How would you describe the impact on the party of Donald Trump and on conservatism of Donald Trump?
Well, it's great talking to you, Robert. Yeah. Let me say, first of all, just so people at the New York Times aren't confused, I am no longer a writer at large of the New York Times, but I do write for the paper still a lot. I'm finishing a book on William F. Buckley and writing for all sorts of places, including the Times. And I mention that because before the Republican convention, I wrote an essay for the Sunday Review about how Trump in some ways was actually good for the Republican Party, or might be good for the party, because what he was doing was exposing the gap between conservative ideology, which can be very rigid and has not changed much over the course of some 30 years or even more, 50 or 60 years if you go back far enough, and what actual Republican voters, who are not so different from Democratic voters, actually want their government to do. And I think, although at the end Trump began to sound more like a conventional conservative Republican, for a long time he didn't. You know, he talked about government that would help people. He looked at the poor, the working class that we're hearing so much about. And he actually was connecting in a way that a lot of conservative ideologues and conservative politicians were not.
Instead of
hear Marco Rubio suddenly sound like Donald Trump.
Yeah. And instead of saying we must have entitlement reform, he was saying, I will protect your Social Security. And that was a different note to strike.
That's right. Or remember at one point, I think it was one of the smartest things he said, and it was really in response to very impressive intellectuals like George Will and Bill Kristol. He said, you know, it's not called the Conservative Party, it's called the Republican Party. And in that sense, I don't want to overinterpret or glorify Donald Trump, but in some ways his instincts are closer to a centrist figure like Richard Nixon than they are, say, to a Ted Cruz. You know, Cruz was the model of a Republican ideologue in our moment. Shut down the government, call Obama a socialist, whatever. Trump is objectionable in many ways, but he's not ideological.
Yeah. My colleague Mara Liason has a question for you.
Hi, Sam. It's Mara Liason here. How are you doing? Nice to talk to you, and
good.
I really enjoyed
nice
your book. I have a question about this. The picture you're painting is something that I heard from a lot of moderate Republicans early on in the race. He didn't really care about the social issues. He was going to move them away from that kind of culture warrior stance. How do you square his pragmatic, non-ideological positions with the what a lot of people say was his authoritarian demagoguery and xenophobia?
Well, those are really good questions. And that's part
frankly,
of the contradiction.
Just asking.
Because you're right, because he seemed to do those things all at once. So I don't have a good answer to that because, well, and let's add his sexism and his sexual predatory history and all the rest. There's no doubt all those things are true. What I would, because I've been trying to figure this out as well, I think the strongest thing he had going for him, the best asset he had for those voters, is that he was clearly not a professional politician. And I think in a moment when all of our everyday life has become kind of pathologically politicized, people almost prefer someone who sounds like he has nothing to do with ordinary politics. And in an odd way, all those things he said that were shocking or repellent or embarrassing gave him added authenticity. And I think in some ways his supporters probably never took a lot of that seriously. I've talked about this with a lot of people. They say, well, what about the fact that Trump insults people? I think what his supporters say is, well, I kind of wish he wouldn't do that. But maybe he'll do better when he's in office.
But they would took also him seriously, but not literally.
And they would also say real people insult other people.
Sam, do you think that Donald Trump, win or lose, has permanently altered the DNA of the Republican Party?
This is a short answer question because we have to move on, Sam.
Sorry.
Yes. Oh, yeah, short answer. Well, yes, he has. Look at where the votes are coming from. Let me add one thing before you all go. I live in a very nice, quite prosperous suburb or exurban town in Connecticut, and there are Trump signs all over the place.
Sam Tannen.
Some of this in Florida.
Sam Tannenhaus, the author of The Death of Conservatism. Thanks for talking with us.
Great talking to you, Bob.
We're going to get a view from the other end of the ideological spectrum now. Tammy Baldwin is a Democratic senator from the state of Wisconsin. She has endorsed Hillary Clinton. She's on the line now. Senator, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
How are you feeling about Hillary Chance's path tonight?
Well, I am still very optimistic. I think it'll be a longer night than some suspected, but, you know, I've been immersed in the campaign here in the state of Wisconsin, and things feel very very promising. Our polls just closed minutes ago, and I'm feeling like we're going to break that enormous glass ceiling tonight.
If Hillary Clinton wins and is successful tonight, do you think she'll be able to implement the kind of progressive agenda that you and many others are hoping for?
Well, she's going to need partners in the Congress, obviously, and so we're watching the Senate races across this country very closely this evening. We've already celebrated the great news of the first pickup of the night, Tammy Duckworth, my namesake in Illinois to due south of Wisconsin. So that's exciting as we watch the night progress. But regardless, we know that there's going to be a very tight balance between Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. Senate. But I do think that as Hillary Clinton has set out her issues, she's also maintained this broad slogan, Stronger Together. And that's in stark contrast to the incredible divisiveness and language that has come from Donald Trump as the standard bearer for the Republican Party.
At the same time, he has made inroads with a lot of voters in this country. No matter who wins tonight, what is the lesson of Donald Trump's nomination for Democrats?
You know, I think it is listening and understanding people's frustrations. I think we have to do a much better job of working together across the party aisle in both houses of Congress and state legislatures across the country, because one of the lessons of Trump supporters is they simply want to blow the whole system up. And so long as there is obstruction, that's going to be the case. That's why, in my mind, it's so important to see a shift from, you know, the leadership of Mitch McConnell, where they've blocked a Supreme Court nominee for the better part of an entire year, to leadership that wants to get things done, whether that's making progress on lowering the debt level of students in higher education, or much more focused policy on the economy to allow hardworking people to get ahead.
Senator Baldwin, are Democrats obliged to make major fixes on Obamacare in order to win back some of the people they've lost here?
You know, I think Democrats have been eager to review and improve the Affordable Care Act ever since it was passed and begun to be implemented, because something that creates such opportunity for 20 million Americans also has some things that need to be addressed as we see how it's working. And what's the problem is that the Republican Senate and the Republican House have precluded that opportunity. And every time that there's been an effort to reform the Affordable Care Act, we have instead seen efforts at outright repeal or defunding, which would be a crisis for so many Americans. First of all, the 20 million Americans who have new coverage because of the program, but also throwing it out wholesale would increase prices dramatically. We got to get more competition. We've got to reduce drug prices. Those are the type of things that we should be able to work together across the party aisle to address and make it work for everyone.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat of Wisconsin. Thanks.
Thank you.
Who now will be, in January, one of two Tammys in the United States Senate, as she said. Tammy Duckworth of Illinois won that seat tonight.
Stay with us. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
In the studio with us, NPR's Mara Liasson and Domenico Montanaro, and Scott Horsley, who's been looking at exit polls throughout the evening. Let's first catch up on the news as we know it. Domenico, anything different to report?
No, I mean, at this point, it is 137 electoral votes for Trump, 104 for Hillary Clinton, as far as the Associated Press's calls are. But there are a lot of outstanding races right now and a lot of surprises. Very close races in Virginia with Trump narrowly ahead with more than 85% of the vote in. Democrats are going to have to hope that those Northern Virginia counties come in and close quickly, because even if they do, it certainly would be a lot closer than she would have liked. And I've talked all along about how Hillary Clinton had a narrow, a broad but shallow, consistent advantage, and that if she held those Democratic states that were leaning in her direction and that blue wall held, that she would win. But right now, Virginia looks like a big cinder block that could be a problem for her. Michigan as well is not where she wants it to be. And New Hampshire also, you know, not a lot in there quite just yet, but neck and neck.
Scott Horsley, you've been looking inside the exit polls this evening. Do they give you any wise insights into what's happening?
Well, I've been looking at a number of states, Robert, Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. In Florida, one of the big questions was what was going to be the shape of the electorate going to be. There was some talk early on of an African-American enthusiasm gap. President Obama made a couple of trips to Florida last week to try to address that. And indeed, the African-American share of the vote went up from 2012, when President Obama won the state. It was 15% this year. It was only 13% in 2012. The Latino vote share also went up, although not as dramatically as perhaps we thought. It went from 17% to 18%. Now, the rise
and
in the
exit polls, by the way, the exit polls do take into account all of the early voting that was done as well.
That's right. And, of course, these are early preliminary exit polls, mm-hmm. so these could bounce around a little bit. But what that has done is to depress the white share of the vote from 67% in 2012 to just 61% this year. Now, on the surface, you might think that would be good for Hillary Clinton, that those Latino voters and African-American voters would help push her over the finish line mm-hmm. in Florida. They may still, but right now she's trailing in Florida, and that's because the margin for Trump among the white voters is bigger than it was for Mitt Romney 4 years ago.
Do you know anything, Scott, about whether or not those voters went as a block to Marco Rubio? African-American voters, Hispanic voters?
I haven't compared what's been looking at they're doing in the Senate race. I'm just looking at the presidential race, I have to tell you.
I just want to return to what you just said, because it's remarkable. If in fact, Donald Trump wins Florida tonight, he will have defied the wisdom of the autopsy that the Republican National Committee performed after the 2012 defeat of Mitt Romney. They couldn't win just by getting more white votes. They had to open up to Latinos and others. You're saying the way he has the lead right now, although it's very tentative, is frankly by having more white votes.
By having more a larger share of the white vote, which is a smaller share of the overall electorate. Now, it's a different picture in North Carolina, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley.
That's Robert Siegel in Washington. I'm Tom Cran, Minnesota Public Radio News, as we continue on election night 2016. Just to recap very briefly, polls closed now in 40 states. Too close to call or not enough tabulation yet in Michigan, Virginia, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, and Colorado. No calls in those races yet. According to AP projections, Donald Trump now has won 137 electoral votes so far. Hillary Clinton has 104. None of those from big battleground states. Mike Mulcahy's here with me, our political editor, beginning to see numbers here in Minnesota, Mike.
Yes, and if you look at the the votes in, it's not very many, about 2% of the precincts reporting. And let's talk presidential in Minnesota. Yep. Trump, 47%. Hillary Clinton, 46%.
Yep.
So really, only a few hundred votes different, not many votes in. Looking at some of these contested congressional races, I think the most interesting one to look at right now is in the 3rd District. Those are the western Minneapolis suburbs, where Eric Paulson, the Republican, is running against Democrat Terry Bonoff. 12% of the precincts reporting there. Paulson has 54% of the vote, Bonoff 46% right now.
All right, Mike Mulcahy with his eye on the numbers for us here in Minnesota. We've got numbers for you online. Make us your second screen tonight at mprnews.org as we continue with Election Night 2016 on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 8:40.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Rachel Martin. In the latest results in the race for the White House, the AP is calling the state of Louisiana for Donald Trump. Connecticut goes to Hillary Clinton.
And big states that could decide the White House, Florida, Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, are still up in the air. We'll have the latest results as they come in.
We should also note that House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin has won his race.
Joining us now is former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. Governor, we don't have numbers in yet on Pennsylvania. Are you confident it's going for Clinton tonight, or has Trump found enough working-class white votes to offset whatever gain she has in the eastern part of the state?
I don't think so. Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia suburbs blew by the 2012 turnout figures for Barack Obama, which I never would have guessed was possible. And I think with the 5 counties doing that well in turnout, there just aren't enough votes around the state for Donald Trump to be competitive. Still a little too early to tell, but from what we see, Pennsylvania is probably the safest of all important states for Secretary Clinton.
How does it look for Katie McGinty, the Democratic senator?
Depends on Secretary Clinton's margin. If she wins by 3, 4, or 5 points, I think Katie McGinty has an excellent chance. If she doesn't, it's going to be a real horse race.
It is incredibly close in North Carolina, Florida, Ohio. Is it closer than you expected it to be in all those?
Oh, absolutely. I was not positive, but I was very optimistic. We carry Florida. That looks like a long shot now. I was not so optimistic about Ohio, but optimistic about North Carolina. And there's still a chance that we'll win North Carolina. But the big shocker is Virginia, although I think knowing where the vote is at, that we have a good shot to win Virginia.
You think there are still votes not counted from Fairfax County in the north of the state that might...
Right, and I think that's probably enough to overcome Mr. Trump's lead.
But if Hillary Clinton wins that way in Virginia, it would be by a whisker. It would be by far less than Barack Obama won it twice. What's happening?
No question.
Why are we seeing this, what we would say, underperforming?
Tremendous performance by Donald Trump among working-class white voters. And you can't deny it. He did it in the primary, and it looks like he's doing it again in the general.
So what's,
whether it's enough to give him the victory and to become president remains to be seen.
So what's the challenge to the Democratic Party in that case? How does it face the challenge of doing that poorly, frankly, with white working class voters?
Well, it depends. If Hillary Clinton's president, then she has to, by what she does, by the action she takes, the policy she undergoes, she has to build back a bond with those working class white Democrats. But if Hillary Clinton loses, then it's much more difficult to rebuild the bonds with those type of voters.
Right now, you're confident about Pennsylvania. You're not the happiest guy I've heard tonight on the air.
No,
worrying you?
I would have thought by now that this would be fairly clear victory for Secretary Clinton. Now, she's doing well in Colorado. I think it looks like she's going to win Virginia. She's doing well in Wisconsin, well in Pennsylvania. The key state, I think, if Donald Trump takes Ohio and Florida and North Carolina, the key state's going to be Michigan.
Michigan.
Keep your eye on Michigan.
Okay. Ed Rendell, former Democratic National Chair and Governor of Pennsylvania. Thanks for talking with us.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Well, that was not the most upbeat report on the developments tonight from the Democratic side. But he thinks that Hillary Clinton can still win Virginia if the votes that haven't been counted yet are from the biggest of the Northern Virginia counties, Fairfax, pretty reliable Democratic county.
Interesting, though, he's already feeling despondent over Florida. We don't know.
We haven't said that yet.
The former governor of Pennsylvania is not feeling too optimistic. Domenico?
And I think that the reason you hear him so despondent is not necessarily because he is convinced Hillary Clinton is going to lose or anything like that at this point, but Virginia in particular, you know, that race has really closed and no one expected it to be quite so tight. It's now only about 10,000 votes separating the two candidates, and you're going to look at someplace like Prince William County where only about a quarter of the vote is in. Fairfax County, about three quarters of the vote is in, a little bit more, four-fifths of the vote. So even if there's enough vote to go over the top there, it's a much narrower margin than the Clinton campaign would have liked.
So we're going to stay in Florida now. We're going to bring into the conversation GOP strategist Mac Stepanovich. He was an early supporter of Jeb Bush and then Marco Rubio. He is not supporting Donald Trump. He's on the line now. Mr. Stepanovich, what are you seeing? Florida polls have now closed, but it's very close. What are you sensing down there?
Well, I'm frankly not unlike Governor Rendell. I'm surprised. I expected Hillary Clinton to win Florida by 2 or 3 points, based on all the things that I have seen, including, you know, private polling here in Florida. So I'm surprised that it's as close as it is. You know, you have to say probably the way it looks right now that unless something extraordinary happens in Broward Bay, with, you know, not that many precincts out, that Trump may actually carry Florida. And if he doesn't, it's going to be very narrow again, very, very thin margin.
Huh. So do you think that vote is a vote against Hillary Clinton, or are people there attracted to Donald Trump's message?
Well, this is not an old Rust Belt state, so, you know, the situation is different here than in Pennsylvania or Michigan. It's always been my feeling that half of Donald Trump's support were people who believed and what Donald Trump was saying, and the other half of people who hated Hillary Clinton. I don't know which of the components of his support is larger at this point, but clearly it's larger than I thought it would be, quite frankly. And, you know, and even if Hillary goes on to be elected president of the United States tonight, I'm going to be a little bit disappointed that her victory isn't going to be so decisive as to be a rejection of Donald Trump and everything that he stands for.
Why do you think that is so important, to have an unequivocal rejection of him?
Well, I would like to see the Congress and the federal government get out of this deadlock that it's been in for so long. And I think that a narrow victory for Secretary Clinton will just encourage the obstructionist Republicans to continue to be obstructionist.
What does this mean, even if he doesn't win, but let's say he carries the state of Florida, your state, you did not support him. What does it mean for the Republican Party, for you as a Republican?
Well, I'm going to be in some meetings next week with some, you know, I and some other folks are going to talk about that sort of thing. The Republican Party generally, and certainly in Florida, has been in the grip of what has traditionally been a very vociferous minority. You know, over the years, you know, you could call them the John Birch Society back in the 50s, or movement conservatives, or the Tea Party, and now the Trump people. It's always been about 20-25% of a Republican primary vote. It's more now, and it's more, like I said, vociferous now, because these populist waves come out of, you know, economic and cultural dislocations like the Great Recession. I mean, you know, Dewey Long Road 1, George Wallace Road 1, William Jennings Bryan Road 1, and now Trump riding one. It'll recede, but a lot of damage will be done before it does.
Mac Stepanovich, a Republican strategist in Florida, thanks for talking with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank
and
you.
We're going to turn to a Republican now who does support Donald Trump, Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
First, what is your sense of the results so far? Do you Do you see that coming down to a very narrow win for either Donald Trump or a very narrow win for Hillary Clinton? I guess it's going to be close no matter what happens.
Yeah, you know, I've said I felt like it would be a two-point race one way or the other, hopeful that it will be a Trump victory and fully believe it's going to be a Trump victory. I think as you look at the unexpected strength that Trump is showing, and it looks as if he's going to carry Florida, Virginia. He is doing great in Virginia and Michigan. The list goes on and on. And I think that probably the Clinton campaign is a little bit surprised by this. They had felt this was going to be a sizable win for them, and it just has not materialized.
You condemned Donald Trump's recorded comments as very vulgar comments about women, but continued to support him. Do you think in the end those statements had any impact on his showing today?
I think more of the impact on the showing today is that, and we're seeing this as the results are coming in, is people are tired of insider Washington, and they wanted an outsider candidate, and they want to send a message that they are sick of the cronyism and the sweetheart deals that are given to friends and families. They are sick of Washington passing rules and regulations, and it cost us jobs. They're concerned about national security and keeping our country safe, and they want to see some things done.
Let me ask you a question.
And you could vote for Trump, which is change, or Clinton, which is status quo, and I think the American people are voting for change.
Let's say status quo wins, just as a hypothetical. Let's say that Hillary Clinton wins a very narrow victory tonight. What attitude would House Republicans take toward her? Is it time to conduct more investigations, consider impeachment? Is it time to try to find some sort of modus vivendi with her where you can actually let the American people see some progress being made? What do you think is going to happen if that is the outcome?
Yeah, right. And regardless of whether you've got a Trump or a Clinton, what House members would like to see, whether they're Democrat or Republican, is to have a White House that is going to work with them on some issues. Most of the bills that we pass out of the U.S. House are bipartisan bills.
Yep.
We have been frustrated that they don't get through the Senate, and we've been frustrated that the White House doesn't back them. So I think regardless of who it is and regardless of which party, that House members would just like to see cooperation.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Marsha Blackburn, representative from Tennessee. Thanks.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
We're going to go now to NPR's Scott Horsley, who is here in the studio with us. He's been monitoring exit polling. Scott, what are you seeing out there?
Well, we talked about Florida, where the white share of the vote was down. North Carolina is sort of the opposite. There we saw limits on early voting, and the African-American share of the vote slipped just a little bit from 23% 4 years ago to 21% this year. Donald Trump is winning with white college-educated men, white non-college-educated men, and white non-college-educated women.
Huh.
But with college-educated women, Hillary Clinton is running dead even 48-48. So if Hillary Clinton manages to hold on in North Carolina, it will be with the help of college-educated women.
So he's winning men outright.
He's winning white men outright, and there are more white men in the mix this year than there were 4 years ago. But the Clinton campaign, and with the help of President Obama, put a lot of their focus on turning out the college-educated vote in the Research Triangle area. You saw President Obama make a trip to Chapel Hill last week. Hillary Clinton ended her campaign in Raleigh, North Carolina. Wake County, which is Raleigh, had sort of underperformed for President Obama 4 years ago relative to Chapel Hill and Durham. So they put a lot of focus on that, trying to drive up the college-educated vote. That's kept it close, but Donald Trump still has a lead in North Carolina.
Well, and I'll put this to the room. We've heard that Donald Trump has a sizable lead with white men in particular, but he needs more than white men or women to win this vote, no?
Well, that was the theory of the case, but we're seeing that theory tested tonight.
Yeah, I mean, look, if Donald Trump is able to motivate white working class voters to show up in numbers that they hadn't been previously, then certainly it's possible. I mean, look, these races had always been very tight in the polling heading in. You know, in Virginia, it may be enough in those northern counties for Hillary Clinton to pull off a kind of a squeaker of a win. It looks like it's maybe heading in that direction.
Right. She's pulled in ahead just, a couple of thousand votes
and
just
now, but that's certainly a lot closer than the Clinton campaign would have liked. And that could mean a little bit of a, you know, if there's a sneeze in northern Virginia, it could mean a cold elsewhere.
Domenico, is the point that voter participation is low enough that if you can really motivate lots of people who are on the sidelines and know if you can change that, maybe you can win by finding more white votes.
If
maybe the wisdom was wrong about
if that's
out.
Well, certainly that could be the case, but I don't know that we've seen any indication yet that turnout is down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need a whole lot more vote to see. I mean, so far we've only got some 50 million.
It would be up in that case. I mean, you'd be drawing more people. And anyway,
It's been more so far the story of the margins.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much bringing a whole lot of new, not previously voting whites in, but upping the margin for Donald Trump.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley and Domenico Montanaro talking about the returns in what appears to be a very, very close race for president tonight.
Robert Siegel in Washington, and I'm Tom Cran, Minnesota Public Radio News at 8:55 on election night 2016. We've got you covered on all of the Minnesota races as numbers begin to come in at mprnews.org and right here on Minnesota Public Radio News. Our political editor, Mike Mulcahy, is here. And what do you see, Mike?
Well, numbers coming in very slowly at this point, with about 4% of the precincts reporting. Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Clinton 47, Trump 46. And again, some of those numbers are coming in from outstates, a few of them from the Hennepin County. And speaking of Hennepin County, in that third district House race, we now have about 30% of the precincts reporting. That's Republican incumbent Eric Paulson has 53%. Terry Bonoff, his DFL challenger, has 47%. And that's really the only congressional race that we have good numbers right now.
Right. All right. We'll continue to monitor those numbers. Our political analysts are here as well, Todd Rapp and Maureen Shaver. And here we stand now. Polls been closed in Minnesota almost an hour. What can we expect to see, Todd, in the next hour or so?
I'm watching carefully the suburban turnout and the split ticket voting. Results are in from Eden Prairie right now. We're seeing, I think, more split ticket voting than maybe we've seen in the last couple of elections. It'll have a big impact on the legislative congressional races in both the third and the second districts, and so I'm going to watch for that. I'm also watching the constitutional amendment. Early returns are in, 76% yes votes, and probably more importantly, less than 5% drop off. If that keeps up, obviously we're going to have independently set legislative salaries.
And that is an amendment that would take the issue of pay of legislators out of that. They wouldn't decide it themselves, but there would be a commission, right?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Half the members appointed by the governor, half by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What about the state legislature? Maureen Shaver, what are you looking for in the next hour as those results start to come in?
Well, as Todd suggested, there are bellwether states districts in the metropolitan area. Things are coming in slowly, but we're starting to see some in Hennepin County, and that's going to give us an indication of whether we've got the ticket splitters and whether Democrats or Republicans are doing well. And Todd and I will start to look at Greater Minnesota, especially up in that 8th district where Congressman Nolan and Stuart Mills are running against each other, and that we think that race and the Trump impact there is going to have a significant impact on legislative races.
And a big Trump-Clinton split nationwide right now.
Nationwide. And
none of the real battleground states have been called yet.
Exactly. They're too close to call. We expect the polls to close in Iowa and the battleground state of Nevada here and at 9 o'clock in just about 2 minutes, as well as Montana and Utah. And if any of those are called, you'll hear it as we continue. There is news we do know tonight that DFLer Ilhan Omar will become the first Somali-American to be elected to a state legislature. You'll recall that she beat longtime DFLer Phyllis Kahn, who was one of the two longest serving legislators in the legislature when Omar defeated her in the August primary.
In that district in Minneapolis, near the University of Minnesota.
60B is the number on that. So we continue to monitor all of that as well here tonight on election night 2016. Make mprnews.org your second screen all evening long, bringing you the latest results counts as they come into us. We have maps for the presidential race and races for the U.S. House and Senate. And now that the polls have been closed here for just about an hour, we expect to have more solid numbers to be able to bring you here in Minnesota. So we'll continue to do that and track what has become a very close race for president nationwide, all in our coverage ahead in this next hour. Stay with us. This is Minnesota Public Radio News 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis-St. Paul, listener-supported radio with full election coverage at nprnews.org. It was a very nice day for voting. We also have our eye on turnout as well. And would it beat either 2012 or 2008 in terms of numbers of voters or percentages? Both in 2012 and 2008, Minnesota led the nation in voter turnout. So when we have a better sense of that, we'll pass it on to you as well. Stay with us as we continue our live rolling coverage of election night 2016. Clear tonight with a low into the upper 30s, a sunny Wednesday tomorrow, the high around 60 degrees, and this sunny and unseasonably warm pattern for the first week in November continues as well, mid-60s, but it looks like for Friday, upper 40s. 9 p.m.